Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision. Thank you for joining us for the Christian Science Monitor, read by April Lee. This is being recorded on November 4th, 2024. Today, we will be reading the following main articles. First, what happens if Trump tries to overturn another election loss? By Cameron Joseph. Second, immigration is not just a U.S. challenge, but on eve of election, it feels that way. By Whitney Ulick. And third, control of the U.S. House is up for grabs and may hinge on two blue states. By Francine Kiefer. And following up with miscellaneous articles. What happens if Trump tries to overturn another election loss? By Cameron Joseph, staff writer, November 4, 2024, 5 a.m. ET, Washington. In speeches, social media posts, and interviews, former U.S. President Donald Trump has been signaling that he is highly likely to challenge the election results should he lose on Tuesday. The big question is what may happen next. Mr. Trump never conceded his 2020 loss, and his extra-legal attempts to overturn that election culminated in the January 6, 2021 U.S. Capitol riot. In this campaign, he has again refused to say he'll accept the results if he comes up short, and is already making misleading claims that the vote is being rigged against him. They're going to cheat. They cheat. That's all they want to do is cheat, Mr. Trump said at a Wisconsin rally in early October. It's the only way they're going to win. Mr. Trump's team has been preparing for this moment for 4 years, organizing on the ground and installing allies on county election boards. The Republican National Committee has invested heavily in, quote, election integrity efforts, training thousands of volunteers to watch for potential fraud. Trump-aligned groups have proliferated across the United States to challenge election results, including a network organized by Cleta Mitchell, who worked with Mr. Trump to try to overturn his 2020 loss. Lawsuits are being filed at a historically high rate, with more legal wrangling a near certainty. There have already been isolated incidents of campaign-related violence, intimidation, and ballot sabotage. Vice President Kamala Harris's campaign is also gearing up for a post-election battle. Ms. Harris told ABC News that her team was, quote, sadly ready to respond should Mr. Trump try to overturn the results. Yet while post-election chaos is quite possible, 2024 is unlikely to be an exact replay of 2020. In important ways, the system has been strengthened. Congress passed legislation making clear that elected officials cannot reject the will of the voters. And states and localities have worked assiduously to harden the voting process against potential attacks. Mr. Trump also doesn't have control over the military or the Justice Department this time around, and it will be Vice President Harris, not Vice President Mike Pence, presiding over the next Electoral College count in Congress. If the election is close, we'll likely see, quote, lots of litigation, as well as, quote, various efforts to challenge the legitimacy of the outcome, says Rick Pildes, a constitutional law professor at New York University. Still, he adds, I think there are many institutional, legal, and even political safeguards in place that should ensure that the lawful winner of the election actually becomes president. What's changed since 2020? Many Americans expect Mr. Trump to reject an election loss. Two-thirds of swing state voters in a Washington Post poll released last week said they doubt the former president will accept the result if he loses this election, including more than one-third of those who plan to vote for him. A majority of swing state voters, 57%, also said they feared Mr. Trump's supporters would respond to a loss with violence. Mr. Trump set off alarm bells among Democrats recently when he declared that he and House Speaker Mike Johnson had a, quote, little secret that could help him win, a comment many took as a hint the House might try to overturn a Harris win. Mr. Johnson said the next day that the secret was simply, quote, one of our tactics on get out the vote, not anything, quote, diabolical. Even if House Republicans wanted to, though, it's unlikely they could block a legitimate win by Ms. Harris, thanks to a new law Congress passed in 2022. The Electoral Count Reform Act, ECRA, made clear that the, quote, alternate elector legal theory cited by Mr. Trump's allies to try to overturn his loss in 2020, appointing rogue slates of Electoral College electors who would back him over Joe Biden, would be a legal no-go in future elections. It would take majorities in both chambers of Congress to reject the law's strictures on certification. And many Senate Republicans who backed the law will still be in office on January 6, 2025, making that an unlikely outcome. The good news is that ECRA is a really big improvement, says Ned Foley, a constitutional and election law expert at The Ohio State University who advised Senate negotiators who crafted the law. The whole approach of ECRA is to basically say that the rule of law controls the outcome and that politicians can't subvert the outcome just because they don't like it. Democrats and Republicans who have stood up to Mr. Trump currently hold the governorships and Secretary of State offices in nearly every swing state, many having defeated candidates Mr. Trump endorsed in the 2022 midterms. That means the officials who are supervising the elections and who will ultimately certify the statewide results are unlikely to side with Mr. Trump if he tries to subvert the law. The biggest risk may come if county officials refuse to certify their results. Trump supporters have attempted this in other elections in recent months, arguing that the votes had problems in their view and should be tossed out. But ECRA, as well as many state laws, have underscored that the certification of election results isn't at the discretion of local officials. They would likely face judicial orders to certify, or face real legal penalties. A strong motivator, though no guarantee. Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, one of the Republican officials who resisted Mr. Trump's demands to overturn their state's results in 2020, told the Monitor in late September that county officials would be forced to follow the law and certify their results, whichever candidate benefited. At the end of the day, state law is very clear, and that cannot be violated. All elections must be certified, he said. That's black-letter law, and everyone has to follow state law. A 2023 U.S. Supreme Court ruling also rejected a Republican-pushed, quote, independent state legislature legal theory that would have given dramatically more power to state legislatures to set rules for federal elections. That decision lowered the chances that GOP-controlled state legislatures could successfully overturn the will of the voters should Ms. Harris win in their state. History rhyming, not repeating itself. But while there are more safeguards around the election process than in 2020, a more fraught situation could still develop if the margin of victory is narrower. The 2020 election wasn't actually that close. All but one of the swing states went for Mr. Biden, who ultimately got 306 electoral votes, far more than the 270 needed for victory. That meant Mr. Trump needed not just one, but several states to overturn their results, and his potential allies in any given state weren't guaranteed success, even if they went along with his efforts. No individual state was close enough to give a legal challenge much of a chance either. Recounts and court fights can swing election results, but it's almost unheard of for a state's results to change if the margin of victory is more than around 1,000 votes. The narrowest margin in 2020 was in Arizona, which went for Mr. Biden by just over 10,000 votes. A closer vote count, however, could lead to a drawn-out court battle. The 2000 election, which came down to just 537 votes in Florida, was fought in the courts and ultimately settled in a controversial decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. This year, it's clear both sides are particularly ready for a courtroom brawl. Dozens of legal battles are already underway. On Saturday, Trump's team filed a lawsuit falsely claiming that several Georgia counties were breaking the law by letting voters drop off ballots, only to have a judge immediately rule against it. Friday evening, the U.S. Supreme Court dismissed a request from Republicans to overturn a Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruling allowing voters who messed up their mail ballots to be able to cast provisional ballots on Election Day. The Trump campaign sued after officials in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, closed in-person absentee voting too early. A judge extended the deadline as a result. Democrats are currently suing in Erie County, Pennsylvania, over mail ballot delays. Republicans have lost last-minute suits in multiple states seeking to tighten rules around military and overseas ballots. While the conservative-dominated U.S. Supreme Court rejected a number of last-ditch attempts to overturn Mr. Trump's loss in 2020, that doesn't mean they do so again in different circumstances. Democrats and voting rights advocates were alarmed last week when the High Court's conservatives ruled that Virginia could restart a purge of 1,600 voter registrations suspected of being non-citizens. The court overturned a unanimous lower court decision that had blocked the effort because it fell in the 90-day pre-election, quote, quiet period, in which federal law prohibits removing voters from the rolls, and because multiple U.S. citizens were found to have been erroneously flagged for removal. Democrats also worry about what the court might do if Republican-controlled state legislatures decide to throw out narrow wins by Ms. Harris and instead send alternate elector states to Congress, something Mr. Trump tried and failed to get them to do 4 years ago. That is now prohibited under ECRA, but that brand new law hasn't been tested in court. Isolated incidents of sabotage, disruption. For all the chaos of the 2020 post-election period, Election Day itself went off fairly smoothly. This year, while early voting has been mostly trouble-free, there have been a handful of alarming, if isolated, incidents of illegal election disruption. In Oregon and Washington, someone set fire to a pair of ballot drop boxes, destroying hundreds of ballots. Footage obtained by police shows the same car at both sites. In a separate, earlier incident, someone set fire to the contents of a mailbox in Arizona, damaging a handful of ballots. In Florida, police arrested an 18-year-old Trump supporter for brandishing a machete at a polling location last week. More than a dozen other cases of election-related violence, intimidation, and sabotage have been identified in recent weeks. The FBI and Department of Homeland Security warned in a bulletin sent to state officials earlier this month that, quote, election-related grievances could motivate people to, quote, engage in violence as we saw during the 2020 election cycle. It does appear as if the Trump campaign and his allies right now are spending more time trying to create a false myth of the inevitability of his victory, says David Becker, a former Justice Department official who runs the nonpartisan Center for Election Innovation and Research. I'm worried about how that could be leveraged post-election, should Trump lose, to create a sense of shock and anger that could result in violence post-election. Immigration is not just a U.S. challenge, but on eve of election, it feels that way. By Whitney Ulick, Special Correspondent, X-Handle, at WEULICH. November 1st, 2024, 1:50 p.m. ET, Mexico City. Illegal immigration is an electoral lightning rod of the 2024 presidential election in the United States. But debates over, quote, criminal, migrants, mass deportations, and American sovereignty obscure a more complicated reality. In particular, who wants to come to the U.S. and why has shifted massively in recent years. Between 1999 and 2009, men from Mexico, often traveling alone as they jumped over the border or waded across the Rio Grande in search of jobs, made up some 90% of those arrested for trying to cross into the U.S. irregularly. Over the past decade, global conflicts, natural disasters, and the COVID-19 pandemic have brought a much vaster and more diverse group of people to America's southern border. Today, entire families flee political oppression, organized crime, war, natural disaster, and poverty. They're coming not only from Latin America, but also from as far away as China and Sierra Leone. Yet the discourse around immigration and asylum seekers remains stuck in a stubborn binary. Black and white, legal versus illegal, says Jennifer Van Hook, a professor of sociology and demography at Penn State and fellow at the Migration Policy Institute. The reality, she says, is, quote, murkier. And that has implications for the way immigration is accepted, or not, and perceived in the U.S. There's a tendency to disregard circumstances in wanting to classify people, Dr. Van Hook says. A complex portrait. Take Springfield, Ohio, which gained national attention this year after candidate Donald Trump claimed its growing Haitian population was, quote, eating the town's pets. Many immigrants there have temporary protected status, which grants provisional rights to work and live in the U.S., yet the discourse centered firmly on America's problem with, quote, illegal immigrants. No group understands the diverse needs and motivations of the constantly changing immigrant population heading to the U.S. better than humanitarian workers in Mexico. On a recent early morning in Mexico City, two men from the International Rescue Committee, IRC, secured tables, a medical privacy screen, and a satellite internet kit to a flatbed truck with neon green straps. These new mobile units respond to migrants spread across the country, not just those hunkered at the northern border. They provide access to phone charging stations and information about migrant rights or new technology in the asylum process. The unit pulls up to the back door of one of the oldest churches in the historic center of Mexico City. Nearby, hundreds of mostly African, Haitian, and South American migrants live in tent camps. IRC Protection Officer Carolina Alvarez Barajas helps an asylum seeker from the Republic of Congo, whose name we aren't publishing for his privacy, download an application on his phone. But she needs help from someone on her team who can translate for her from French. Although the app called CBP1 is the first step for an appointment at a port of entry before filing for asylum, it is only available in Spanish, English, and Haitian Creole, languages that are essentially useless to scores of migrants here today from Africa who speak French or Portuguese. The Congolese man, who says death threats forced him to flee home, selects Spanish on CBP1 and screenshots the buttons he's supposed to press to check in on the app daily until he's assigned a date to travel to the border for an interview. He expects it could be months. Not just an American challenge. Mr. Trump has long railed against undocumented immigration, going so far as to call migrants, quote, rapists. Nearly 90% of his supporters favor mass deportation of unauthorized immigrants. Meanwhile, Democratic candidate Kamala Harris has faced widespread criticism for her perceived role in 2023's record-high border crossings, which have since plummeted. She now says she supports a tougher crackdown. But this isn't an American-only challenge. Mexico is adjusting to record immigration numbers and its effects, too. Over the past decade, Mexico has formalized, under pressure from the U.S., the policing of migration on its southern border. As Border Patrol encounters have fallen since historic highs last December, apprehensions inside Mexico have grown. Double in the first half of this year compared with the same period last year, according to the Danish Refugee Council and IRC. Amid restrictions on asylum seekers in the U.S., Mexico has had to strengthen and expand its own system. It's now among the top five receiving countries in the world for new asylum claims. Hundreds of thousands of migrants are now coming to Mexico from across the globe and remaining longer, sometimes permanently. That has kicked up tensions in some neighborhoods in Mexico City and at the northern border. But unlike in the U.S., the population surge is met with more sensitivity in Mexico, says Eunice Rendon, Mexico coordinator of the Agenda Migrante Initiative. Because of Mexico's history as a country of migrants, quote, we have more empathy around what is driving people to leave home, she says. While anti-migrant voices in the U.S. focus on violence perpetrated by migrants, in Mexico they are clearly victims of it. In a migration reversal, amid an uptick in violence among cartels in southern Chiapas state, some Mexicans are crossing south into Guatemala for safety, says Rafael Velasquez Garcia, IRC's Mexico country director. Organized criminals target migrants to boost revenue by selling fake CBP1 appointments or charging, quote, exit fees to move around the country, says Mr. Velasquez. They are now finding even greater opportunity with what we estimate are about 1 million people stranded in Mexico. Anywhere else in the world where you have 1 million people stranded in an environment like this, we would recognize it as a humanitarian crisis and respond to that, he says. But right now, there is no humanitarian response plan. The majority of the response is on the shoulders of local civil society. In 2014 came a notable uptick in children and families arriving at the U.S. border from Central America, many fleeing violence and intentionally turning themselves over to border agents. That trend has only grown since the pandemic, with huge implications for humanitarian work in Mexico. When a church in Mexico City, La Parroquia de la Santa Cruz y Nuestra Señora de la Soledad, began opening its imposing hand-carved doors to migrants in 2017, volunteer Claudia Torres says they were still aiding mostly young men who were just passing through. By 2020, they were helping entire families with young children. Now they work with volunteer midwives who help deliver babies, sometimes even under the church's roof. Families are more complicated, says Ms. Torres, who sits on the church patio registering arriving migrants, including a young mother from Ecuador who walks in seeking to bathe her two sons. Once the family walks away, Ms. Torres gestures for another volunteer to come near. It was that little boy's 7th birthday earlier this week. We'll sing him the mañanitas, she tells her, referring to Mexico's iconic birthday tune. By the time the boy's mother has scrubbed behind his ears, there's an impromptu party, complete with a tray of chocolate-covered marshmallows and a small crew of volunteers singing and cheering. The boy beams. This scene, as joyful as it is heartbreaking, bears little resemblance to the rhetoric on the American campaign trail. Editor's note, this story was updated on November 1st, the same day as publication, to clarify the role CBP-1 plays in the asylum process. Control of the U.S. House is up for grabs and may hinge on two blue states. By Francine Kiefer, staff writer, X-Handle at KIEFERF. October 31st, 2024, 3:42 p.m. ET, Santa Clarita and Newport Beach, California. California and New York are reliably Democratic, so no suspense there for Tuesday's election, right? Wrong. These two states may well determine control of the U.S. House of Representatives, where Republicans currently hold a whisker-thin majority. If Democrats can flip just 4 seats, they will retake control. And California and New York have more swing districts than anywhere else, including many GOP-held seats in districts Joe Biden won in 2020. Between them, they may well determine whether the House acts as a brake or gas pedal for the next president. In this era of tight margins, it's not a given that Democrats will get what they need in these blue bastions. And even if they do, the gains could be canceled out in other states where Republicans are trying to flip seats, such as Pennsylvania, Michigan, Alaska, and Maine. The fight for the House is as close as the fight for the presidency. And I don't think either party has a clear advantage in either one of those races, says Nathan Gonzalez, editor and publisher of the nonpartisan Inside Elections. With partisan gerrymandering greatly reducing the number of competitive districts across the United States, Mr. Gonzalez's nationwide rankings list just 15 pure toss-ups, 5 of which are in New York and California. 4 more seats in those states are rated as competitive, but slightly favoring either Democrats or Republicans. The coattail effect. House races are notoriously hard to poll, and in an era of nationalized politics, the top of the ticket in a presidential year can have a huge impact. Democrats feel they got a reprieve when President Biden dropped out of the race last summer and Vice President Kamala Harris became the nominee. They're hoping she'll draw more voters to the polls and that those voters will pick Democrats all the way down the ballot. California is Ms. Harris's home state, and she has support from 59% of voters there. That strength could be the difference in competitive districts like CA-13 in the agricultural Central Valley, where Republican Representative John Duart beat his Democrat opponent by a mere 564 votes in 2022. Similarly, Republican Representative Mike Garcia eked out a win in CA-27 in northern Los Angeles County by 333 votes in 2020. On Sunday, Mr. Garcia's Democratic opponent, George Whitesides, rallied volunteers for a home stretch push at a park in Santa Clarita, a northern suburb of Los Angeles. The district's lines were redrawn after the last census, and Democrats now outnumber Republicans there. Still, quote, Trump trains of pickup trucks and flags run regularly through this part of the Mojave High Desert, home to a state prison and Edwards Air Force Base. The heavily Latino district has thrice elected Mr. Garcia, a decorated Navy combat pilot and former Raytheon executive. Mr. Whitesides, who is running as a moderate Democrat, has an aerospace background as the former CEO of the Mojave-based space tourism company, Virgin Galactic, and a former chief of staff of NASA. His wife is Cuban and Salvadoran. He boasts of having created 700 local jobs, an important consideration for commuters to Los Angeles who battle two-hour drives each way, high gas prices, and higher housing costs as more people move from LA to the exurbs. The Garcia campaign is attacking Mr. Whitesides for his political donations, including to unpopular progressive LA County District Attorney George Gascon and the LGBTQ plus advocacy group Equality California. The group supported a bill equalizing sentencing for sex crimes. An attack ad accuses Mr. Whitesides of having, quote, funded a group opposing pedophiles registering as sex offenders. The Whitesides campaign is hitting Mr. Garcia for his votes against the bipartisan infrastructure bill and against the bill that included a price cap on insulin for older adults, and for rejecting the electoral count for Mr. Biden in 2020. And they've hammered the congressman for his, quote, no exceptions opposition to abortion. Though, in a statement, Mr. Garcia says he does support exceptions for rape, incest, and the life of the mother. In an interview, Mr. Whitesides said, choice is obviously a huge deal that cuts across demographic groups and parties. Even though the California Constitution protects reproductive rights, voters are worried about a national ban and concern for women in other states, he says. With polls showing his campaign ahead by 2 points, he says he feels, quote, cautiously positive. A 2022 drubbing for New York Democrats. On the other side of the country, in New York, Democrats have high hopes for retaking the seat held by Representative Brandon Williams, a first-term Republican who represents Syracuse. In 2022, the former Navy submarine officer defeated his Democrat opponent by less than 1 percentage point, and his all-in stance for Donald Trump puts him at odds with his redrawn district, which shifted from Biden plus 7 to Biden plus 11. Democrats are aggressively going after 3 more New York seats and eyeing a cherry on top at the tip of Long Island, says Jacob Smith, an assistant professor of political science at Fordham University. In the 2022 midterms, held not long after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, Democrats did better than expected nationwide, with an anticipated red wave largely failing to materialize. But in the Empire State, the party got swamped, says Professor Smith. That drubbing in New York, however, now means Democrats have an opportunity to win back those seats. Professor Smith points to an October poll by Siena College that shows Ms. Harris leading Mr. Trump by 19 points among likely voters in the state, a big jump from September when she led by 13 points. If the trend holds, that sort of a rising tide lifts all boats, he says. On the other hand, in California, state GOP chairwoman Jessica Milan Patterson lists lots of reasons she believes the environment is fantastic for us. Mr. Trump may be polling at only 33% in the state, but that's little changed from 2020, when Republicans picked up 4 House seats there. Before that, they hadn't flipped a seat from blue to red in California since 1994. They gained another in 2022. Republican registrations overall in California have been rising after years of decline. Ms. Patterson notes that since she took over party leadership in 2019, it has registered more than 820,000 new Republicans. Party investments in community centers that serve Latinos and Asians in swing districts have made a huge difference, she says, noting that Representative Garcia gained 18 points among Latinos from 2020 to 2022 after the GOP created a community center in his district. The party saw a similar shift in Republican Representative David Valadao's Central Valley District, CA-22, where it has another Latino center. Ms. Patterson, herself Latina, says Latino voters are the pathway back to sanity in the state. The independent Cook Political Report notes that Democrats are showing signs of slippage overall in California, with Ms. Harris running 6 points behind Mr. Biden's 2020 vote share in a recent poll. And that slippage appears to be driven largely by Latinos. While Mr. Biden won that group by nearly 40 points in 2020, the vice president is currently winning them by only 20. Republicans have an easy explanation for all of this. Persistent problems with homelessness, border security, affordability, and crime. California Democrats have destroyed the Golden State, says Ms. Patterson, pointing to high levels of support in polls for Proposition 36, which would increase punishment for certain drug and theft crimes. Crime is something Scott Bau hears a lot about when he knocks on doors. The Republican former state legislator is running for the open seat vacated by Democrat Katie Porter in Orange County, where seats have flipped back and forth between parties. This district, CA-47, has been reconfigured and is rated by most election analysts as a toss-up or lean Democrat. But Mr. Bau is ahead of his challenger, Democratic State Senator Dave Min, by at least 3 points in some polls. People are uniting around the constant stories about crime, says Mr. Bau in an interview at a rally in Newport Beach on Saturday. Many voters here were shaken by a murder during a botched robbery outside the city's upscale Fashion Island Mall this summer, followed a month later by another robbery and shooting there. All of our Orange County Republicans are going to get reelected. I'm going to be elected. Even Democrats know that, says Mr. Bau on a morning thick with marine fog. We will maintain the House majority and grow it, he says with confidence. With polls that lie within the margin of error, no one will know until after Election Day. Even then, it could be weeks before the outcome is clear, because of the heavy use of mail-in ballots in California and the time it takes to count them. A Bridge to Humanity, behind a Monitor series on an underreported story. Yes, the U.S. presidential election will be consequential, and yes, big powers and proxies are being drawn into high-profile conflicts. Our international news editor tells why and how we went deep on Sudan, too, where civil war has been devastating, but where resilience and agency endure. By Clayton Collins, Director of Editorial Innovation, and Mackenzie Farkas, Associate Multimedia Producer. November 1, 2024, 9 a.m. ET. A land war in Europe. Widening strife in the Middle East. A U.S. presidential election. The West tends to lose sight of the African continent even in less distracting times. But there's plenty that's worth attention in the more than 50 countries there. Sudan's current conflict is especially stark. What makes it really grave is that both sides are using starvation as a weapon of war, says Peter Ford, the Monitor's international news editor. Also present in Sudan, cooperation, resilience, and agency. Our stories in and from Sudan are about how people can rise above that chaos and the difficulties, and they can find ways of working together to overcome their problems, Peter says on our Why We Wrote This podcast. That coverage, which included a recent series organized by Johannesburg-based editor Ryan Lenore Brown, helps give readers a really different picture of life in Africa. The work builds a bridge for Monitor readers. It's a kind of bridge of humanity, if you like, Peter says. And I find it a very fulfilling job to keep that bridge maintained. To listen to this episode, please find the Christian Science Monitor's podcast called Why We Wrote This, and this episode is titled Why We Went Deep on Sudan. Moldova's pro-West president, re-elected, slams external hostile forces. President Maia Sandu won a second term in a runoff against a Russia-friendly opponent, Alexander Stoyanoglo, in a race that was overshadowed by claims of Russian interference, voter fraud, and intimidation in the European Union candidate country. By Stephen McGrath and Vadim Girda, Associated Press, November 3, 2024, 8:44 p.m. ET, Chisinau, Moldova. Moldova's pro-Western president, Maia Sandu, has won a second term in a pivotal presidential runoff against a Russia-friendly opponent in a race that was overshadowed by claims of Russian interference, voter fraud, and intimidation in the European Union candidate country. With nearly 99% of votes counted in the second round of the presidential election held Sunday, Ms. Sandu had 55% of the vote, according to the Central Electoral Commission, or CEC, compared with 45% for Alexander Stoyanoglo, a former prosecutor general backed by the pro-Russia Party of Socialists. The result will be a major relief for the pro-Western government, which strongly backed Ms. Sandu's candidacy and her push for closer Western ties on Moldova's path toward the EU. Moldova, you are victorious. Today, dear Moldovans, you have given a lesson in democracy, worthy of being written in history books. Today, you have saved Moldova, Ms. Sandu said after claiming victory after midnight. She went on to claim that her country's vote had faced an, quote, unprecedented attack through alleged schemes including dirty money, vote buying, and electoral interference, quote, by hostile forces from outside the country and criminal groups. You have chosen that nothing can stand in the way of the people's power when they choose to speak through their vote, she added. Speaking before the final vote count, Mr. Stoyanoglo told the media that, quote, everyone's voice deserves respect, and that he hopes, quote, from now on, we will put an end to the hatred and division imposed on us. When polls closed locally at 9 p.m., turnout stood at more than 1.68 million people, about 54% of eligible voters, according to the CEC. Moldova's large diaspora, which cast ballots in record numbers, voted heavily in favor of Ms. Sandu in the runoff. In the first round, held October 20th, she obtained 42% of the ballot but failed to win an outright majority. The presidential role carries significant powers in areas such as foreign policy and national security and has a 4-year term. European Union Commission President Ursula von der Leyen congratulated Ms. Sandu on her victory, writing on X, "It takes a rare kind of strength to overcome the challenges you've faced in this election." Allegations of vote buying. Moldova's diaspora played a key role in the presidential vote and in a nationwide referendum held October 20th, when a narrow majority of 50.35% voted to secure Moldova's path toward EU membership. But the results of the ballots, including Sunday's vote, were overshadowed by allegations of a major vote-buying scheme and voter intimidation. Instead of winning the overwhelming support that Ms. Sandu had hoped, the results in both races exposed Moldova's judiciary as unable to adequately protect the democratic process. On Sunday, Moldovan police said they had, quote, reasonable evidence of organized transportation of voters, illegal under the country's electoral code, to polling stations from within the country and from overseas, and are, quote, investigating and registering evidence in connection with air transport activities from Russia to Belarus, Azerbaijan, and Turkey. Such measures are taken to protect the integrity of the electoral process and to ensure that every citizen's vote is cast freely without undue pressure or influence, police said. Moldova's foreign ministry said Sunday afternoon that polling stations in Frankfurt, Germany, and Liverpool and Northampton in the UK had been targeted by false bomb threats, which intended only to stop the voting process. Stanislav Sekyeru, the president's national security advisor, wrote on X, "We are seeing massive interference by Russia in our electoral process," which he warned had a high potential to distort the outcome of the vote. Mr. Sekyeru later added that the national voter record systems were being targeted by ongoing coordinated cyber attacks to disrupt links between domestic polling stations and those abroad. Moldova's Prime Minister Doran Resian said people throughout the country had received, quote, anonymous death threats via phone calls in what he called, quote, an extreme attack to scare voters in the former Soviet Republic, which has a population of about 2.5 million people. In the wake of the two October votes, Moldovan law enforcement said that a vote-buying scheme was orchestrated by Ilan Shor, an exiled oligarch who lives in Russia and was convicted in absentia last year of fraud and money laundering. He denies any wrongdoing. Prosecutors say $39 million was paid to more than 130,000 recipients through an internationally sanctioned Russian bank to voters between September and October. Anti-corruption authorities have conducted hundreds of searches and seized over $2.7 million in cash as they attempt to crack down. Moldova's EU future at stake. Christian Cantier, a Moldovan associate professor of international relations at Oakland University, told the Associated Press that whatever the outcome of the second round, it will not deflate geopolitical tensions. On the contrary, I expect geopolitical polarization to be amplified by the campaign for the 2025 legislative elections. Moldovan law enforcement needs more resources and better trained staff, working at a faster pace to tackle voter fraud, he added, to create an environment in which anyone tempted to either buy or sell votes knows there will be clear and fast consequences. A pro-Western government has been in power in Moldova since 2021, and a parliamentary election will be held in 2025. Moldova watchers warn that next year's vote could be Moscow's main target. In the wake of Russia's invasion of Ukraine in 2022, Moldova applied to join the EU. It was granted candidate status in June of that year, and in summer 2024, Brussels agreed to start membership negotiations. The sharp westward shift irked Moscow and significantly soured relations with Chisinau, where playgrounds benefit adults and a bridge between art and science opens minds. By Erica Page, staff writer, X handle at ERIKACP. PAGE. November 4, 2024, 10:28 a.m. ET. The benefits of greening Denver's schoolyards have rippled outward. Landscape architect Lois Brink began thinking more about the impact of playgrounds after seeing the bleak yard at her children's school. Between 2000 and 2012, she helped Denver Public Schools transform 99 schoolyards into vibrant, green spaces that prioritized physical activity, creative play, and outdoor learning. A recent report commissioned by the Children and Nature Network found that these greener yards reduce average ambient temperatures in the summer, sequester carbon and remove pollutants from the air, and improve students' academic performance and well-being. Given gains in high school graduation rates and community health, the analysis estimates the improvements could return $3 to a community for every $1 invested. Denver voters twice approved ballot measures to fund transformations that cost an average of $630,000, which were also aided by pro bono services, volunteers, nonprofits, and the city. Green schoolyards are, quote, a multifaceted solution, said Priya Cook of the Children and Nature Network. Markets tend to underinvest in strategies that produce broad benefits to society. We have to think differently to pick multi-solving interventions. Sources, Grist and Children and Nature Network. Oslo's climate budget is making it easier for the city to meet its climate goals. Created in 2016 after Norway signed the 2015 Paris Agreement, the climate budget puts a limit on citywide emissions, tracks progress, and recommends new interventions. As a fiscal tool, it is integrated into the budgeting process affecting all municipal departments. The budget is helping the city transition to electric vehicles, create net zero construction sites, expand cycling lanes by 100 kilometers or 62 miles, and install carbon capture technology. Since 2016, the city has reduced greenhouse gas emissions by 28% and is on track to reach 65% by 2030. Cycling has increased by 51%. Our politicians got tired of climate action plans that they sent out into the bureaucracy, but then it was never really followed up, said Heidi Sorensen, director of the Oslo Climate Agency. They needed a governance system. The framework has inspired 200 other Norwegian municipalities to follow suit. Source, World Resources Institute. Ethiopia has dramatically reduced the threat of tuberculosis. While largely controlled in some parts of the world, TB continues to be a leading cause of death across Africa. Ethiopia had the world's highest mortality rate from TB in 1980, with 394 deaths per 100,000 individuals. Following decades of public health initiatives, the East African country has reduced that rate sixfold, outpacing the progress made by countries facing the same problem. In high-income nations, fewer than 1 in 100,000 people die from the disease each year. Still, life expectancy overall has increased across eastern sub-Saharan Africa more than in any other region in recent decades, largely due to efforts in addressing TB and other prominent diseases. Sources, Our World in Data, and Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation. Lavender oil can be used to make mosquito-repellent fabric. Traditional synthetic repellents protect against mosquitoes and the diseases they carry, but can cause their own health issues. Lavender oil is a natural alternative, but its compounds break down quickly in normal conditions. Textile engineer Zishan Tarek and Xiaoqin Wang at Soochow University in China discovered a way to prolong the effect. Their team mixed lavender oil into a warm solution of fibroin, a flexible protein made by silkworms, and gum arabic, a substance from acacia trees that helps stabilize materials. When stirred, the mixture forms tiny lavender oil capsules that can be embedded in cotton fabric. Tests show that gloves made from this fabric significantly reduced mosquito landings compared with regular gloves. Even after 40 washes, the treated fabric remained effective. Source: The Economist. And with that, we'll wrap up our show for today. Thank you for listening to the Christian Science Monitor, read by April Lee.
The content featured in this recording may not reflect the views of AfterSight or the presenter. For questions, concerns, or editorial feedback regarding the Christian Science Monitor, please contact them directly at customerservice@csmonitor.com or call 617-450-2300 Monday through Friday.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.